We know that Amnesty has a massive campaign to demonize Israel.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am
with Shai Davidi.
My guest for today is Hillel Neuer, Executive Director of UN Watch. One thing that I was shocked when I first met you, and we met in person the first time a month ago, Hillel, is you're a giant. Like, I've seen you for so long fighting, really a fight on your own, and I was expecting to see a 9-foot giant. And you're not. You're just like everyone else. That was really shocking to me. Sometimes you're not supposed to meet the people that you look up to.
It's only downhill from here.
It's only downhill from here, but I'm really excited to have you on the show. So here I am with Hillel Neuer. Hillel, I'm going to start with the same question that I ask every person. Hillel Neuer, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm all in. I grew up in a very Jewishly committed family, and my parents met in a Jewish summer camp that's called Camp Moshova. It's part of B'nai Akiva youth movement. My grandparents, who lived in Poland, were part of a Zionist group that was sort of the precursor to B'nai Akiva in their small town, in their shtetl in Poland. And when my grandmother left around 1930, more or less, in a shtetl outside of Lemberg or Lvov in Galicia, we have the notebook that her friends, they had some kind of a get-together to say goodbye to her. She went to Canada to join her boyfriend from her shtetl, who went before her, and they got married, my grandparents. And when she left, there was some kind of a farewell party of some kind. And she had a pinkas, she had a notebook where people had messages to her. They were in Yiddish, some were in Hebrew, and it was from her religious Zionist movement. And they said, a number of them said, we'll all meet again in Israel one day. Most of them were murdered. She had the good fortune to leave Poland in the 1930s. Most of them were murdered. She never saw them again. But that's the family that I come from. So my family has always been committed to traditional Judaism, religious Judaism, Zionism. A number of my family members, including my grandmother, who had moved to Canada, her husband passed away when she was young, so she became a widow, and she was very active in what's called Mizrahi women, or in Canada it's called Emuna women. It's connected to B'nai Akiva, and they were helping the kibbutzim, and she would raise money like nickels and dimes for Israel and have events. You can go to old newspapers and you can find things. In the 1950s, I can see in Canadian Jewish newspapers at her small little rented flat in Montreal, she was a widow, she would be having events, selling things in a bazaar to help send money to Israel. And eventually, when she was in her late 60s or something, she left Montreal to move to Israel, which this is in 1980. She moved to Petah Tikva, which was, as you know, was not a metropolis. Today, if you go to Petah Tikva, you could think you're in Manhattan. Giant, tall buildings.
I wouldn't say, just to be fair, like, I live near Petah Tikva. Petah Tikva is the butt of many jokes in central Tel Aviv, in central Israel, in Tel Aviv. It's not close to Manhattan.
It's not Manhattan, but
it's the Hackensack to Tel Aviv, Manhattan.
But just, yeah, I was shocked because I remember being there in the early mid '80s, and it parts of it looked nothing like what it is. But she went there. It was the time when in Israel you had, as you may recall, you had to wait 8 years to get a telephone and all that. And she was thrilled to be there. So that's in just sort of an origin story. That's the kind of family that I come from. I went to Hebrew school my whole life. The Jewish people, Judaism, it's something that my family is all in. When I grew up and we had Shabbat meals, there'd be a discussion. My parents are very interested in history, intellectual history, Jewish philosophy, and there'd be some kind of intellectual Jewish discussion, and someone would say, "Ah, we need to look at the encyclopedia," and that was the Encyclopedia Judaica, which we'd bring out to answer the question about who was so and so, when did Maimonides live, when were the Dead Sea Scrolls, or whatever it was. And then once it was open, this giant encyclopedia, it wouldn't go away. We'd sit there, and so that's the background that I come from.
Growing up in Hebrew school, Hebrew camp, whatever institutions. The people that grew up with you, would they say about themselves that they're also all in?
Most of them, you know, everyone chooses their own path. Some people, you know, leave Judaism and so forth. So everyone chooses their own path. Most of my friends who went to my Hebrew school and that I'm still in touch with, most of them are still all in. Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing. So we're going to get to your work. I want to spend a lot of time discussing your work and maybe even the nuances of it. But before we get to your work, I want to understand how you became the person that you are. And you grew up in Montreal, as a Jewish kid, teenager. Have you ever felt anti-Semitism, hatred toward the Jews, towards Israel? What was the experience of growing up?
So I lived largely in a Jewish world. I went to Hebrew school my whole life. I lived in a Jewish neighborhood. But it wasn't an entirely Jewish neighborhood. On my street, actually, was quite multicultural. There was next door to me were Greeks and Jamaicans and Italians and people of all kinds. So it was a Jewish neighborhood, but also a multicultural neighborhood in Montreal. It's called Côte des Neiges area. And from time to time, there was anti-Semitism of the old school. I remember once walking, I think, downtown in Montreal wearing a kippah, and some people passed by in a car and shouted out, I don't know, dirty Jew or something like that.
So there'd be. Do you remember how old you were?
Yeah, I want to say maybe 9 or 10 years old, something like that. So you remember just someone kind of shocking, someone just shouting out at you from a passing car. And I think they turned around to shout it out at my brother and myself. So there were a few, I would say, isolated instances like that. And we were mindful that there was anti-Semitism, again, of the old kind. You know, in Montreal and Canada before World War II, there were signs on hotels, certain of them, certain clubs, saying no Jews. So that was, you know, pre-war. And some of that lingered. Quebec was a very old school Catholic province. So there was some, you know, old school Catholic anti-Semitism that existed. And you knew in certain areas you might encounter more of that kind of anti-Semitism. I remember we used to go up north in the Laurentian Mountains, where many people from Montreal have a summer cabin. And we'd go up there, and there in the smaller towns where people did come from that more rural background. I remember once I was wearing a kippah, and someone said, this was sort of a French Canadian from this part of Quebec, said, why do you cover your head? Is it because you have holes in your head?
Holes.
Or horns. I can't remember if he said holes or horns, because, you know, there's some misinterpretation
of
Hebrew.
You have a deformity.
No, it's an old misinterpretation of the Bible, where it says that Moses, had karnayim, which I think in Hebrew it can mean rays of light, but it was misinterpreted as horns. So there's some, in some of the European art, there's Moses with horns, because it's a misinterpretation of the Hebrew. Moses did not have horns, according to the Bible.
And I should say, you know, for people now watching, neither does Hillel Noor.
Right. Right. So you believe. That was just ignorance, right? To answer your question, isolated instances from time to time, but not significant, not significant.
And you keep referring to old school
right.
anti-Semitism,
right.
which begs the question, what is that contrasted to? What is new school? Current anti-Semitism.
So current anti-Semitism is a group that calls itself the leading human rights organization of the world, Amnesty International, accusing the Jewish state of the ultimate crime, genocide. That is contemporary anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is, for those who don't know, it is the ultimate virus which mutates. And when society, whatever is virtuous in society, the virus of anti-Semitism will find its way to portray Jews as the opposite of that virtue. When society was religious for well over 1,000 years when society was Christian, then Jews in Christian societies were accused of killing Christ. You killed God. And that worked. If you killed Christ, you're the enemy of humanity, the enemy of God. You're the enemy of virtue. And then when society was in the Enlightenment, Jews were somehow anti-Enlightenment. They were tribal. They were reactionary. When society was communist, Jews were the capitalists. In capitalist societies, Jews were the communists. And in Nazi Germany, when the ultimate virtue was race, Jews were poisoning the race, and they were the Übermensch and subhumans, and somehow poisoning the race. And in our time, in post-war era, in the 21st century, the ultimate virtues are human rights and anti-racism. And not accidentally, Israel is then accused of being the ultimate human rights violator and the ultimate racist state. And in a new twist of not just being a committing human rights violations, but the ultimate human rights violation, genocide. And that's a next level accusation, which effectively seeks to remove the taboo of anti-Semitism. Meaning, before World War II, in many Western societies, you could be openly anti-Semitic, and people were. We don't want Jews in our clubs, we don't want Jews in our universities, and that there were quotas of all kinds. After World War II, after the Holocaust, it was embarrassing, it was shameful to be openly anti-Semitic. There still was anti-Semitism, but it kind of went underneath the wraps. And I grew up in that era, benefiting perhaps in the best time for Jews in thousands of years, when it was shameful to be anti-Semitic. And that taboo is connected to the Holocaust. But when you accuse Jews of being like the Nazis, and it now is a culmination of what we've seen over five decades, because the Nazis were the occupiers. So Israel is an occupier. The Nazis were racist. Israel is racist. The Nazis committed war crimes. Israel commits war crimes. The Nazis committed genocide. They committed the Holocaust. Ah, but now Israel is committing genocide. Those who accuse Israel of genocide, falsely, there is no genocide. It's a lie in Gaza or anywhere else in Israel. That is done deliberately to undo the taboo of anti-Semitism, to say, we've been soft on the Jews. We've been hesitant to go after them because there was the Holocaust, the Nazi genocide. But if they've committed genocide, then we don't really have to hold back at all. They're doing the same thing.
But if I were a representative of Amnesty International, mm-hmm. and by the way, pre-October 7, that wouldn't been something that I would consider.
Sure.
It's human rights. Who doesn't want to work for human rights? But let's say there was someone here from an Amnesty International saying, this isn't anti-Semitism. Like, you're contrasting old school anti-Semitism of Jews have horns with what we're doing, which is just calling out war crimes, atrocities. We wrote a 300-page report about the genocide. Who are you to say that's anti-Semitism? What would you say to someone from Amnesty International, or maybe someone just listening who doesn't have a horse in the game and sees a supposedly respected organization putting out this report and then sees you and I saying that report is wrong?
Sure. So there's this report, and there's many things connected to it. So let me give a little bit of the background, not that it's necessary. I mean, the initial thing I would say is that it's not just a lie, it's a fantastic lie designed to demonize Israel. The truth is that there was a ceasefire in place for 2 years. On October 7th, 2023, Hamas invaded Israel, committed a massacre, and Israel responded to try to stop the terrorists, and people were killed. The people who were killed is the cause of Hamas. Hamas, those the innocent people who were killed in Gaza is the cause of Hamas. Hamas deliberately embedded their terrorist infrastructure under hundreds of miles of terror tunnels built underneath homes, hospitals, and schools. And so when Israel went to kill the terrorists, sadly, Hamas deliberately planned it so that innocent civilians would get killed. A war and a defensive war have nothing to do with genocide. So it's just a fantastic lie. If Israel's committing genocide, then every other democracy that was defending itself against terrorists or aggressors, whether it's the Americans fighting the Nazis, or any other defense of war would be genocide. And that's a fantastic lie. So it's a lie, and we know that amnesty has a massive campaign to demonize Israel and to tell lies to demonize Israel. We saw even in the report, they redefined genocide. Well, first the report opens up by saying, on October 7th, Israel launched a major offensive against Gaza. No, that's a complete reversal of what happened. On October 7th, I was in Israel. I remember in Jerusalem at 8 o'clock in the morning when I heard the first siren. Things were happening before, but I only heard it first at 8 a.m. I remember being in the rocket in the bomb shelter, and Israel was invaded by Hamas, and 1,200 people were massacred. And right away from the first sentence, Amnesty twists it on its head and accuses Israel. And that this is consistent throughout the report as a complete reversal of the truth.
But why? Why does Amnesty, like, Amnesty is not like some abstract entity. It's people. It's people that work there. And by the way, probably because it's a NGO. Yeah. They probably could be earning more somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So these people are dedicated to human rights. They're dedicated to fighting ills all over the world. Why this ill will?
Yeah. So I'm not sure if all of them could be earning so much elsewhere, but let's assume that they're doing something that is a not-for-profit work. It's not the best salary and so forth. Many of them are ideological, and we can agree on that. And they would believe that they are ideologically virtuous and altruistic. And I would say that those who seek to do ill will often mask their intentions, cloak it under virtue. So they may actually have aggression, but cloak it in as if they're advocating for human rights. I mean, to give the extreme example, it's not a good, I don't like to go to the Nazis, but of course, you know, Hitler was said that he was defending the rights of the Sudeten Germans. That was his claim. So the fact that you claim human rights is not sufficient for people to agree that it is. But if many of the people at Amnesty are radical, anti-Western, anti-Israel, and in some cases, anti-Semitic. Let's give a few examples. The head of Amnesty UK for 20 years was someone named Kate Allen. Was very anti-Israel. And just understand sociologically who these people are. Her husband for 20 years was a guy named Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London, or also known as Red Ken. He's someone who said Hitler was a Zionist. So it was a huge, huge controversy.
Hitler was a Zionist.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what was his, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, what is his logical explanation for that?
His twisting of the truth, if I recall, in the 1930s when Hitler began to persecute the Jews, a number of them wanted to flee to wherever they could go. Mm-hmm. One place was Palestine. There were Jews who wanted to flee Germany to Palestine, and the Zionist groups tried to help them move, and there were some kind of agreements made with the German government how they could sell their property. So they took things that are true and twisted it to say Hitler was a Zionist. Something like that.
So this is Ken Livingstone. His wife
was the head of Amnesty UK. Just understand the sociology of these people. No. Everyone knows who Jeremy Corbyn is. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who, like Amnesty International...
By the way, not everyone knows what's listening and watching... Jeremy Corbyn was the head of the Labour Party
in the UK.
Famously,
almost became prime minister. Yeah,
famously, mourned Fatah and PLO terrorists. Talked about his Hamas friends, etc.
Our friends from Hamas and Hezbollah. Yeah. He said Hamas and Hezbollah are, I forget the exact word, something like that. They're social justice friends and they're progressive.
Put a reef on the grave of terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and he's someone who many rabbis in the UK who were never political and people on the left who would always vote for Labour, Jeremy Corbyn galvanized virtually every Jew in the UK to oppose him because he was a clear anti-Semite. And eventually he was kicked out of the Labour Party and he was condemned by the Labour Party and by many in British society, including courts, for anti-Semitism. So he and Red Ken, they're all speaking in the name of the same values that Amnesty claims to speak of, anti-imperialism, human rights. These were people who in the early 70s would have been Maoists or open supporters of the Soviet Union and communists. And that ideology morphed into the language of human rights in the 70s and 80s. And so it became, they took over the human rights movement, even if they don't necessarily truly believe in human rights. But sociologically, to understand Amnesty International on the political map, one shouldn't think that they're apolitical. That would be a great mistake. They're on the political map, but they're on the far, far left. Their people are sociologically Red Ken and his wife for 20 years, Jeremy Corbynites. They're all of the same ideology. And they've been going after the Jewish state for decades. Just a few examples. In about 15 years ago or so, Amnesty did a 120-page report on Islamophobia, saying that Muslims are being persecuted in Europe. And someone at the annual meeting of Amnesty International said, let's do a report on anti-Semitism.
Which, by the way, I believe that many, many Muslims feel targeted. You know, as Jews, it's a visible minority, and people probably do experience a lot of Islamophobia. That, you know, someone said, let's do another report, not instead of...
Right. That, right. That's right. I think certainly there has been discrimination against Muslims. The danger, of course, about the term of Islamophobia is that it ends up protecting the belief system itself and not the individuals. No Muslim should ever be discriminated against. And I wrote a letter to the New York Times a number of years ago when the Swiss, not everyone knows this, but the Swiss constitution was altered about 15 years ago to say the following: the construction of minarets is prohibited. That's the Muslim tower next to the mosque. And that was targeting Muslims in the Swiss constitution, and it's there today. The construction of minarets is prohibited. And I said that was targeting Muslims, and it's wrong. So I'm against targeting Muslims. Islamophobia is a very controversial term because it protects the belief system itself, and there are many rules at the UN and other places that you can't criticize Islam, and that's a whole other kettle of fish than but Muslims. But we agree that you shouldn't discriminate against Muslims, and those who wanted to investigate anti-Semitism weren't trying to stop protesting discrimination against Muslims, but rather, in addition, investigate anti-Semitism. And a vote was held at the Amnesty annual meeting in the UK, and they voted against doing a report on anti-Semitism. And on Twitter, someone asked them, why did you do that? And the answer from Amnesty International was, well, we can't campaign on everything. That was the literal answer. We can't campaign on everything. However, when several years later, around 2019 approximately, or 2020, when the Amnesty International issued its first report accusing a country of being a racist country, of being an apartheid country, that country was Israel. And they were asked, there was a famous interview in the Times of Israel, Lazar Berman interviewed Agnes Callamard, the head of Amnesty International, and Philip Luther, the head of, I think, the Middle East Department, was in Israel, and he interviewed them, and he said, I'm just curious, have you accused any other countries of apartheid? No. Have you thought of looking at the Uyghurs, the Muslim Uyghurs in China, you know, a million of whom are in camps and have their beards cut off, and they can't practice their religion or speak their language, and have been, China's been accused of genocide by the State Department, the Canadian Parliament. Have you done a report on whether that's a form of apartheid? They said, no. And have you investigated any other country for this crime of apartheid? No. Why did you start with Israel? Got to start somewhere. So just to wrap up, why did you refuse to do anything on anti-Semitism? Can't campaign on everything. Why do you only accuse the first country in the world you accuse of apartheid is Israel? Got to start somewhere. I could give you, you know, dozens of examples. There's even, you know, crude anti-Semitic jokes made by certain Amnesty people. You see, and it's their major campaign issue, time after time, accusing Israel of crimes, the Jewish state, time after time, is their major homepage campaign. The charges themselves are false, and the fact that they single out Israel more than any other country in this manner is the contemporary form of anti-Semitism.
I want to get to your work at UN Watch, but before that, I want to point something in the dynamic of what you just said. You and I can be having this conversation, and I assume many of people watching this and listening will be nodding along because they've been following the news. They've been not just following the news, but meticulously following the news, seeing what's coming out of Amnesty International, the Red Cross, etc. Someone from the outside might hear this conversation and would just brush it away as hypochondriac Jews. Jews that are just being extremely sensitive. All they said is they got to start somewhere. All they said is you can't campaign. Can you campaign on everything? Of course not. Do you have to start somewhere? Of course you have to start. What do you say to someone like that? Someone who doesn't have literal skin in the game like we do and says the Jews are just overreacting.
Yeah, well, I'd say a few things. First, in the case of Amnesty International, there are dozens and dozens of examples that one would ought to mention. Examples that they've hosted at their events, a Hezbollah supporter who denied the Holocaust and was openly homophobic, and they said, well, we agree with him on Islamophobia, so we didn't pay attention to that. Last week, Amnesty International invited as a speaker a woman named Francesca Albanese, who has been condemned by four countries for anti-Semitism, including France, Germany, the U.S. Special Envoy on Anti-Semitism, the Canadian Special Envoy on Anti-Semitism, the only U.N. expert in history to be condemned by the people that I just mentioned, the French government, Germany, Canada, the U.S.,
but
for anti-Semitism.
But she did get the red carpet treatment at Columbia University.
Right. And she spoke at Barnard.
Barnard College. And unfortunately at Princeton, which is
and
also
Princeton
where
and
I
Georgetown,
was before.
And Georgetown.
New school where I worked before.
Right.
And I don't know if she made it to Cornell, but I'm sure that, you know, they would have loved having this open.
And just so people know, this is someone who wrote in an open letter on Facebook, said that America is subjugated by the Jewish lobby. America subjugated.
Not the Israeli lobby.
No, the Jewish lobby. So overtly anti-Semitic. And she's just recently, in the past year, been condemned by all these governments. Amnesty International made her their key speaker. And there's just one example after another of terrorists that they've supported. And you see a deliberate campaign to demonize the Jewish state, to elevate those. Albanese also told Hamas conference in November 2022, you have the right to resist. And there's dozens of examples.
They listened.
That's right. It was a year before the massacre. And I invite people to see, we did a report called Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. Many of these UN experts have the imprimatur of being a UN expert, a human rights expert, and you scratch a little bit and you see actually they're not very different than a fascist anti-Semite. They're just of the extreme left variety. But at the end of the day, she is enabling, legitimizing, justifying, encouraging those who murder Jews openly, like Hamas. And she does this all the time. And Amnesty made her their keynote speaker at an event just last week. So there's all these different examples. And you just see also, this systematic campaign to twist everything against Israel. And if you see all of these things, you see a clear pattern. The pattern emerges and it's clear. Look, I used to be a human rights lawyer I've been 20 years at UN Watch. Before that, I worked at a large law firm in New York called Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison. It's one of the major firms in America, noted for its civil rights work. And one of the cases that I worked on was discrimination against African Americans in the U.S. Air Force. And there's something called a pattern and practice of discrimination. You begin to show 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, a dozen, all these examples, a pattern and practice of discrimination emerges and you make your case to show discrimination. When it comes to Amnesty International, this pattern of practice of discrimination is severe and extreme.
It's depressing.
It is, because it's the largest human rights group, and they've, you know, and it's not just on Israel. You know, this is the group that told Alexei Navalny, you're not a prisoner of conscience. Then they backtracked. You know, he's the famous Russian dissident who was left to die in Russian prison by
Putin.
Well,
he was
Putin.
First poisoned by the Kremlin, then arrested, then died.
Left to die in prison.
Left to die, or we don't know the...
Yeah, right. Right. So, and then, you know, Amnesty International, this is sort of beyond their anti-Semitism, but it shows that their moral compass is broken. Again, an organization founded in 1961 to free political prisoners, whether being held by communist dictatorships or right-wing dictatorships. It was supposed to be apolitical amnesty for political prisoners. And they've morphed into something which is the complete opposite today. When Russia bombs Ukraine, they said, well, you know, in some cases, Russia might be justified. They issue this report about a year and a half ago, a report that was attacking the Ukrainians, accusing them of war crimes. Russia loved it. Russian propaganda was embracing the Amnesty report. Many people from Amnesty resigned, heads of Amnesty in Scandinavia and elsewhere in protest. So it's an organization that has become sick. And I wrote in a tweet, I said, Amnesty is dead. We need to create a new human rights movement. Stay tuned. And that's because I'm speaking to a lot of people who recognize that, who see that those who march in the streets of America or in Western countries claiming to speak for human rights, but who end up embracing genocidal terrorists. And this is the crowd that had no problem with Assad, most of them. And actually they thought that Assad maybe is on their side. And, you know, Amnesty, they've done things against Syria for sure. But I just checked, you know, because we're speaking now as the Assad regime has fallen, they're opening up the prisons and there's thousands of prisoners and they did horrific, unspeakable atrocities to these people, torture and worse. And I see that Amnesty in the past, in more than 1 year, they did two tweets on Syria. My group, UN Watch, it's a tiny group, we're staff of 10. They're a staff of hundreds and hundreds around the world. They did two tweets in 1 year, we did 29. Tweets. They did just two tweets on Syria since from August 2023 until now, December 2024, Amnesty did two tweets on Syria. So something is screwed up in their moral compass, and it is terribly sad because it's the largest human rights organization in the world, so-called. They are quoted. And it's not that they're wrong on everything. You know, a broken clock is right at least twice a day, and they do have different divisions. They have a division on Iran that will sometimes say the right thing. But the heads of Amnesty International, Agnes Callamard, who's the world head, and many other others, their focus, I went on the homepage this morning, and it's all about Israeli genocide, which is a complete lie. Hamas was genocidal, openly stated. Israel is trying to stop a genocide.
So let's get to UN Watch. You're the executive director. What is UN Watch? What was it founded for? What does it do now?
So UN Watch was founded in 1993. We've been around just over three decades by a great civil rights leader named Morris Abram. He was a pioneer in the United States fighting discrimination against black people. He did so before it was popular. Meaning,
was he Jewish?
He was Jewish. He was a Jewish lawyer from a small town, Fitzgerald, Georgia. He studied law at the University of Chicago. During the war, he was in the U.S. military. He served as sort of a law clerk on the Nuremberg War Tribunals in Germany and came back to America, was a lawyer in Atlanta, Georgia. This is in the 1950s. And he saw how black people were discriminated against, and he began to speak out for them and fight for them as a lawyer. And again, this, in the 1950s, it wasn't popular. By the 60s, it became a movement, but to be not black in the 1950s and to be speaking out for black people was not popular. He was very close with Martin Luther King and his father, Daddy King. He helped get Martin Luther King out of prison. He connected the King family to the Kennedys, and he fought in 1963 and won the Supreme Court case declaring one man, one vote, that the racist county system in Georgia, which was designed to minimize and diminish the black vote, was racist and illegal. And actually on his epitaph, Morris Abram is buried in the United States. He died around the year 2000. And it says he enshrined the principle of one man, one vote in American law. So that was our founder. He was one of the leading, I'd say, non-black civil rights leaders. There's a photo in 1965 of a conference on civil rights in the White House. And there's Martin Luther King and other eminent black civil rights leaders. And there's one non-black person, that's Morris Abram. And he was head of the United Negro College Fund. He was a Jewish leader. He was head of the American Jewish Committee. He actually became a lawyer at Paul Weiss, where I worked. We never met, but he was there in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And eventually he was named U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in Europe, in Geneva. And there, representing the U.S., he saw what
under,
was one...
Under which president? Do you...
George Bush the father. So George Herbert Walker Bush. This is 89 to 93. So he was the U.S. ambassador. He saw the infamous Human Rights Commission, as it was then called. He saw the Syrians accusing the Jews of killing Christians and using their blood to make matzah. He saw that happening at the UN.
These are Syrians under Assad's
father. Hafez Assad, yeah, Hafez that's Assad. Right, yeah. The defense minister, Mustafa Tlas, had published a book about that. And if memory serves, the Syrian delegate was like citing it in one of the debates of the Human Rights Commission. And he saw these awful things. And when he retired in 1993, he stayed in Geneva rather than go back to America. And he had the idea to create the first independent watchdog of the UN, not against the UN. He actually himself was an advocate of the United Nations and was a UN human rights expert himself. In the 1960s, Morris Abram served on the UN Subcommission on Human Rights and drafted the UN Convention Against Racial Discrimination. So he was a champion of the UN.
But why does the UN need a watchdog? I mean, who is Maurice? We got newspapers, we got the media. They have press conferences in the UN. Each country obviously sends people funds. Why do we need a watchdog?
Well, because the various people that you mentioned, none of them is really holding them. The UN to account. Journalists do it from time to time, but it's much, much more rare than it ever was today. Most journalists at the UN are really just note takers. They're sort of transcribing what the UN spokesman says. Very few of them are holding the UN to account in any meaningful way. They will even tell me. Journalists who cover the UN will say, "Hillel, you've showed me some very awful things that are happening in this or that UN agency, but if I raise it, if I write about it, I'm going to get cut off. I'll lose my access to the spokesman of the Secretary General or the High Commissioner. I might lose my office," because they give you an office, a very nice office in Geneva or New York at the UN. So they get the access. And in exchange for the access, it's expected that they'll go along with the UN narrative. Not always, there's a few exceptions, but it's very hard to find those exceptions today. So very few individuals, agencies, institutions are actually holding the UN to account. And it should be the member states. You know, the UN is answerable to the member states, and they should do it. And there was a time when the United States did try to do it. But of course, governments come and go. They have their own agenda. We do need outside entities to know about the UN, to care about the UN's values, and to hold them to account. You know, in a democracy in the United States, the government does something wrong, they can be held to account by the Congress. They can be held to account by the judiciary. You go to court, get it struck down. It's happened many times in America. If the president is a bum, you elect the other guy. You can have demonstrations. You have freedom of information, access. You have freedom to debate. At the UN, you have none of these things. When an awful UN decision happens, if the UN elects China to their Human Rights Council, which actually happens all the time, whenever there's an election, China, Cuba, Qatar gets elected to the Human Rights Council. 60%.
So backtrack. And I know, like, for you, all of this is...
No, go ahead.
This is what you do all day. Yeah. You just told me, and people listening, that China, Qatar...
Cuba,
Eritrea. The countries that have probably one of the worst records of human rights violations, they get elected to the Human Rights Council.
The highest intergovernmental human rights body in the world.
Who's electing them?
The General Assembly.
Why is the General Assembly of the UN electing members of the countries that are supposed to be examined by the Human Rights Council?
Politicization. Today, victims and supporters of human rights worldwide have the right to ask this panel, is the UN keeping its promises? They have a right to ask, why was Venezuela, whose Maduro government just days ago attacked innocent civilians and burned trucks carrying life-saving humanitarian aid, elected to this council repeatedly over the past 6 years?
Why are they being elected? Like, if I was going to hold a, you know, task force on campus against sexual violence, I would likely not bring in convicted rapists. That wouldn't even, it's not political or ideological, it's common sense. Why are we being elected to the council?
We're a strange world. And sadly, more often than not, the foxes are chosen to guard the chickens.
But what's the mechanism?
Why? Yeah, so the UN General Assembly is 193 countries, one country, one vote. Sounds democratic. But actually, if you give dictators a vote, there's nothing democratic about that. Giving a vote to the Chinese communist regime, which oppresses 1.5 billion people, giving a vote to the Assad regime. By the way, Assad as we're meeting here, Assad has just, you know, fled the country and he's now in Russia. His regime has collapsed, but his ambassador is still at the UN and still has the vote. The UN didn't get the memo yet. So that it'll take time for them to figure out how to deal with that situation. But the UN has this bizarre situation that has the appearance of democracy, majority vote. What could be undemocratic about that? Except those voting are often unelected dictators. So,
and what's the ratio in, you know, you don't need the exact numbers, for like democratic countries that have one country, one vote at the UN versus totalitarian dictatorships.
Right. So in the General Assembly itself, which is 193 countries, it's probably about 50-50, but the Human Rights Council, it's even worse. Meaning at the Human Rights Council, it's many more dictatorships. It's at least 60% of the members of the 47 members council are dictatorships, and there's a reason for that. It's important to understand the motive. When the General Assembly holds elections to a human rights body, you would think, by logic, that those who care about human rights would be the most eager to put their names forward. But let's wake up and understand the real world. In the real world, the serial violators of human rights do not want to be held accountable. They want to avoid, even though the Human Rights Council doesn't have the power of the sword, has no soldiers, has no army, does not have the power of the purse, doesn't have billions of dollars of budgets, but the mere power of shame, it turns out, matters in the world. That if you are, precisely if you are unelected, if you are an unelected dictatorship, like the Chinese Communist Party, like Vladimir Putin, like Bashar al-Assad, like Maduro, who is sitting in power even though the vast majority voted against him, you know, and like Zimbabwe, in Venezuela, and like Zimbabwe, and we could go on for dozens of regimes, they understand that if there is, if their legitimacy is challenged, they have no legitimacy. When you're a dictator, you go to sleep at night, you know that if enough people start shouting, you know, let's get rid of the dictatorship, people might be convinced. In a democracy, no, a vote was held. The majority voted for us. So you can protest, that's fine, but the majority voted. And they voted for us. We're elected. So what we see at the UN is precisely the unelected regimes are the most eager and energetic and robust in blocking out any form of international criticism because it could be used against them. So if the UN were to condemn China, which they'd never have done, then it might embarrass them and it might empower dissidents in China who might say, well, the UN has condemned this regime. This must be a bad regime. So in order to gain false international legitimacy, the Chinese Communist Party, the Cuban Communist Party, Maduro dictator in Venezuela, and all the others, they push hard to be elected to the Human Rights Council. And so the paradox, the absurd paradox emerges that the worst regimes in the world use every resource they have, political, economic, diplomatic, to do deals, dirty deals behind closed doors. I'll give you something. You'll vote for me. I'll vote for you. We'll give you money. We'll do this for you. And they get elected. Venezuela was elected numerous times to the Human Rights Council under Chavez and under Maduro, both of them dictators. Chinese Communist Party, always there. The Cubans, the Qataris. Russia's Putin was there many, many times. Only recently they were blocked because of Ukraine. And it's because they push and a vote is held. The vote officially is supposed to be according to some criteria. Does the country contribute to human rights? What is their record on human rights? What pledges have they made? Nonsense. In the end, it's political considerations, sadly, which with a few exceptions, but political considerations trump human rights, and the worst regimes time and again get elected. And that's why 60% of the members, the 47-member Human Rights Council, are made up of dictatorships and other forms of non-democracies.
Going back to the metaphor of sexual violence, if Colombia was to set a task force against sexual violence and model it after the UN, we'd have 60% rapists.
Yes. Yeah. And we're there. We're there, this lone voice saying something's wrong here.
So tell me, what do you do at UN Watch?
Yeah. So UN Watch, our mission is to monitor the United Nations according to the principles of its charter. The charter of the UN was adopted in 1945 with the great principles of liberal internationalism, freedom, international peace and security. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, his brilliant brain trust. They're the ones who drafted the UN Charter. And it's a magnificent document. So too, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which today as we meet is Human Rights Day. It was adopted 76 years ago today in the Palais de Chaillot in Paris, in a special session in Paris of the UN General Assembly, with Eleanor Roosevelt introducing it and it being adopted. So the founding principles of the UN are noble and good and valid and relevant. Our organization embraces those values. We invoke those principles to hold the UN to account, to tell them, you don't speak in the name of the UN. We speak in the name of the UN. My founder, Morris Abram of UN Watch, wrote the UN Declaration Against Racism. You dictatorships at the Human Rights Council, you are hijacking and distorting the true principles. You're against the principles of the UN, and we're holding you to account. We're calling you out. And we do it by doing research and reports and facts, which we put out on social media, in major newspapers, on TV. We speak at the UN. That's a whole other topic we can come to, where we're recognized as a non-governmental organization. We speak at the UN. We are a thorn in their side, trying to wake them up, sound the alarm, and bring them back to what they were supposed to be.
So that's the next question. So I'm glad you brought that up, because you're talking about where you speak and what you say. But if there was a metaphor to describe you personally and UN Watch, I would say it's the emperor's new clothes. In Hebrew, it's called Bigdei HaMelech Chadashim, the new king's clothes. It's the story of the king, the emperor, who is somehow convinced to walk around naked, and everyone pretends like everything is okay. And then the one
child, yeah, boy, yeah.
Brave, right. Child who is not, his mind has not yet been distorted.
He didn't get the memo.
He didn't get the memo. Points and said, the emperor is naked. And there, it drops the veneer of the emperor. Are you being listened to? Who is listening to you when you're coming and saying, emperor is naked?
Yeah, that's our challenge. Sometimes we are certainly heard by many. We speak at the United Nations. Sometimes, you know, I spoke in a synagogue several years ago in Montreal, 700 people there, and I told them what's wrong with the UN and how to fix it. And a woman stood up in the crowd and she said, this is, everything you're saying is good and I agree with it, but why are you saying it here? Why are you speaking in the synagogue? You need to say it out there. You need to tell the world. I said, madam, I just told you in my speech how I speak at the United Nations, at the Human Rights Council. So most of my speeches that I give are actually at the United Nations. The Human Rights Council in Geneva, one of its saving graces, and it's not ironclad, is that NGOs can speak. It's an anomaly. It was grandfathered in decades ago. In New York, an NGO basically can't speak. It's just ambassadors of countries who speak. But in Geneva, after the ambassadors of countries speak, they invite non-governmental organizations to take the floor. It means you were accredited by the UN. They acknowledge that you're an NGO. There are several thousand of them. Only a few hundred come to Geneva at different times during a debate to speak. And we get to speak. And there I speak. And there certainly all the ambassadors hear me. And it's published on the UN website. And many hear.
There's a difference between hearing
and
listening.
That's right. Yeah.
As someone who has two children, I can tell you, they hear what I say. They listen.
Yeah, right. So who listens? You know, there's a spectrum. And oftentimes the governments themselves hear but don't want to listen. Too many of the ambassadors, the governments they represent, go along to get along. And I'm not talking about the dictatorships, meaning we know what Xi Jinping of China and Vladimir Putin of Russia and Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, we know what the dictators will do. We don't have any expectations from them, but we would expect the Netherlands, France, Germany, the UK, America, Canada, Australia, we would expect them to do the right thing. But too often they don't, because they're cynical, because the ambassadors themselves are part of the system. Doesn't look good if you criticize the UN. There's so much pressure to go along, to get along. Not to say anything, when the representative of Syria every year for decades is reelected the rapporteur of the UN Committee Against Decolonization, which is against the subjugation of peoples. So Bashar al-Assad, who was controlled with Iranian troops and Syrian troops, he was one of the leaders of the Committee of Decolonization. And no one says a thing. Antonio Guterres just spoke in February at the same meeting that elected Syria's representative to a high position on this committee. He said, your committee is crucial, and he didn't say a thing. Just yesterday, he said Assad was a dictatorial regime, words he never used before in his life at the UN.
Because Assad is gone.
So now he's a hero. So sadly, most even of the democracies go along to get along. Not all of them, but most of them go along to get along. And they don't want to, you are told by the system, if you complain, if you call it out, you'll be punished in various ways.
Sounds like academia. Sounds like Columbia University, actually.
And So who's listening? Many of the governments don't want to listen. So it's our job to go not necessarily to the foreign ministries, which we try. And sometimes there are governments that are more friendly than others. The Canadian government under Prime Minister Stephen Harper from 2006 to 2015 was open to listening to these things and would speak out when we would bring reports to them. And the government of Justin Trudeau, much less open to hearing about these things. So it depends on the government. And so our role is, you know, one issue we've been active on is the UN has an agency that's supposed to help Palestinians who are called refugees, who live in Lebanon and Gaza and other places. And it's called UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency. And we have exposed over a decade how this school system run by the UN systematically celebrates terrorists. Teachers day after day glorify Hitler, celebrate terrorist attacks on their Facebook pages. Leaders of UNRWA institutions are themselves terrorists. The head of the UNRWA teachers union in Lebanon, Fathi al-Sharif, was the head of Hamas in Lebanon, which even the New York Times acknowledged yesterday.
Wait,
sorry, it's a whole other kettle of fish.
It's a whole, like, for so many things.
Maybe, yeah.
The head of UNRWA teaching. So this is a UN agency that is supposed to take care of refugees, and we can talk about, you know, what counts as a refugee.
Yes.
And why only in this specific context refugees is a status if it goes
perpetual,
from generation
yeah.
to generation, which is a problem, and we can talk about that. But just the fact that someone employed by the UN was also the head, or still is the head, of Hamas.
So Fathi al-Sharif was the head of the UNRWA teachers union in Lebanon, overseeing 2,000 teachers, and he was the head of Hamas in Lebanon. Now, we knew that he was an important...
Well, why is this not like headline? This should be something like, if this was about the head of Boko Haram, this was head of Al-Qaeda, head of ISIS...
Of a UN agency.
It's working...
A humanitarian agency.
And his salary is funded by taxpayers' money, by us. Mostly, you know, a big portion from the U.S. government. So by Americans from the Midwest are paying a Hamas leader
salary
through the UN.
Correct.
And this is not huge news.
Correct. Yeah, I've been shouting about it for the past 6 months. I wasn't actually shouting, but I was sounding the alarm. I spoke in the EU Parliament and the Dutch Parliament and the Austrian Parliament and the Swiss Parliament, where I've just been invited today to appear again in January, about these issues. And I was in the Swiss Parliament and I said, you think that Philippe Lazzarini, who's the Commissioner General, who's very soft-spoken from Switzerland, he's the Commissioner General of UNRWA, you think he's the head of UNRWA? No. He's the face that's designed to raise money from the United States, which gave $1.2 billion in the last 4 years to UNRWA. Now the money is frozen. And you think he's head of UNRWA, but he's not the head of UNRWA. The real head of UNRWA is Fathi al-Sharif, who was the head of the teachers union in Lebanon, and Su'ail al-Hindi, who was the head of the teachers union in Gaza for many years. He is on the Hamas Politburo. And is now, since many Hamas leaders have been killed, he's based in Turkey, and he's become one of the more quoted spokespersons deciding what to do about the hostages. He was head of the UNRWA teachers union. No outrage.
You know what? Now I know where my taxpayer money is going. I pay a lot of taxes every year because until now I've been doing well, and I enjoy paying taxes because that's what we pay for a society. And now I know part of my taxes pay for the head of Hamas in Lebanon and political leader of Hamas.
Correct. So
let me ask you this, because I want to talk a lot about the UN.
Right.
Why is the UN so obsessed with Israel? Or is it just in my mind that it's obsessed
with? No, it's not on your mind. If you go on the unwatch.org website, we have a dedicated website called unwatch.org/database, the UN Watch database. And on the UN Watch database, we give the numbers. How many times has the UN Parliament, the UN General Assembly, how many times have they criticized various countries? So how many times have they criticized some of the worst abusers of the world? Last year, they criticized Syria once. They criticized North Korea once. They criticized Iran once. And one or two other countries once. Maybe Russia twice. Israel was condemned 15 times. Israel, which is a democracy, fighting against terrorist groups, was condemned 15 times more than North Korea.
You know, but someone would say, okay, the past year has been a complicated year. There's been a war.
Right. Right.
What about before that?
بإسم الشعب الفلسطيني ثلاث دول حازت على استقلالها الوطني وعلى عضوية هيئة الأمم المتحدة وهي غينيا بيساو وبنغلاديش.
Right. Yeah, good question. So it's way before the war. It's been happening for about 5 decades. Began in the 70s when Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, which was a terrorist organization, they invited him to speak at the UN in 1974. He came with his holster. He said the gun wasn't there, but he came as a militant.
Well, he came in full terrorist uniform, right, donning his famous keffiyeh, which we now see in city centers and universities, and his gun holster.
Right, yeah. So since that time, basically, the Soviet Union cleverly made an alliance with the non-Western countries, which are called the Non-Aligned Movement, but basically made them aligned against America and Israel, and began, it's harder to condemn America because countries will suffer, but against tiny Israel, it was easy. So many countries from Asia and Africa joined the Arab countries with the Soviet Union and began to obsessively target Israel. So this has been going on in a given year, this, in 1980 and 1990 and 2000, it would be like 20 resolutions on Israel for various reasons. They've gone down a teeny bit. It has nothing to do with the war. It's been going on for decades, even when Israel is at its most conciliatory moments, even when Israel is pulled out of Gaza, made a peace treaty with Egypt, a peace treaty with Jordan, the annual condemnations of Israel recur year after year. And what's important to understand is these resolutions make no mention at all of terrorist groups, no condemnation whatsoever of Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, terrorist groups or repression by the Palestinian Authority. These are not resolutions that truly care about human rights for anybody in that region. It's all about condemning one country. Just last week, you know, we're meeting now when the evil atrocities of the Assad regime are laid bare. We're discovering atrocities people didn't want to know about or didn't know about from prisoners emerging from underground prisons. And just last week, the United Nations General Assembly voted that Israel must give the Golan Heights to the Assad regime, to Syria, which is the Assad regime. Today, it would be the al-Nusra, the HTS, which is some kind of Islamist group headed by someone who's on the UN terrorist list.
And we should also note that the Golan Heights have been acknowledged by the US government as part
sovereign territory. Yeah. Yeah. So the UN has been Orwellian in that regard, obsessively in ritual condemnation of Israel. The world meets and they condemn the Jewish state. And again, this was engineered by the Soviet Union and the Arab states, the Islamic states, with the support of the Non-Aligned Movement. If you ask why do these large majorities vote for these resolutions, I will tell you that, again, they're typically introduced by the Arab and Islamic states. They have, there's vote trading. So the UN, if you vote for me, I vote for you. There are 56 Islamic states. There are countries that are not against Jews, but they're just looking out for their own pocketbook, realpolitik. If I vote for the resolution against Israel, 56 countries will support whatever issue I have for my country.
A bad deal.
Not a bad deal. Or for me personally as an ambassador in New York or Geneva, there's so many UN committees you could get elected to, UN position you could move into after you leave being an ambassador. Very nice, tax-free. Living in Geneva, you're skiing on the weekends, you have a BMW. It's a very quiet, nice life.
All you have to do is throw the Jews under the bus.
So vote trading, oil. although Israel has discovered some gas, it's still nothing compared to the Arab oil weapon, which has been used for 50 years. You don't vote for us, you don't get oil. Sovereign wealth funds, Qataris have billions of dollars. If you don't vote for us, we don't invest in your country. Fear of terrorism, if you're one of the handful of countries, America, sometimes Canada, sometimes Australia, sometimes a few other countries, if you're one of the handful of countries that vote against us, your country could suddenly become targeted by terrorists, maybe Hamas, maybe Hezbollah, maybe Al-Qaeda. There's a whole long list of terrorists that might want to go after your country. So fear of terrorism. All of these reasons, Shai, I don't like them, but I can understand them. Vote trading, oil, wealth fund, fear of terrorism. It's rational. It's not principles, but I can understand how many countries might say, all right, it's in my interest. But if I were to tell you that's the only reason why Israel is demonized at the UN, I would not be telling the full truth. Because I have witnessed in 20 years at the UN, many countries, including European countries, who go along with 2/3 of the resolutions. If there are 15 condemnations of Israel in the past several years, 10 out of 15 are supported by European states. And when I see the EU states voting yes for 2/3 of these resolutions, when I see the Irish ambassador voting yes, or the Spanish ambassador, I don't see him or her straining to raise their hand, knowing that it's wrong and one-sided and demonizing, but because of the oil and the vote trading and the fear of terrorism, they raise their hand. No, I see them very comfortably and almost with enjoyment raising their hand to condemn the Jewish state. And I have to tell you that living in Europe, I'm mindful of the fact that a millennia ago, when there was the Black Plague in Europe, the Jews were accused of poisoning the wells. And that comes back to what we spoke about before. If there are human rights abuses in the world, if there's war in the world, we see that the modern form of anti-Semitism is to condemn Israel. Israel's become the Jew among the nations, scapegoated. And in my, what I witness, because you see things, you read things, but you see things, and I see the Jewish state being scapegoated time and time again, even by countries that are democracies. And I would say the additional factor, other than the realpolitik, is something that is not rational, that is perhaps supra-rational, and that's Israel being treated as the Jew among the nations and scapegoated. Fun topics.
Fun topics. And I do want to add some hope, because I feel like you are not a inherently pessimistic person. I may be wrong. I have heard you say that there are some people that call like burn it all down. We don't need the UN. And you said, well, if the UN doesn't exist, we'd have to create one. So the UN exists. It's a reality. Both my brother, my younger brother, and my older sister were, as kids, teenagers, participated in Model UN, where they would go and they would learn about a country and they would get an issue and they would have an assembly and
debates.
And I was thinking about that yesterday, thinking about our conversation. And I realized that the Model UN is not working well, because it's preparing kids to operate within a flawed system. What it should be doing is working with kids to create a model UN, a UN that would actually work better. And if we were to start that, I want to know, Hillel, what is your model UN? If you could create it from scratch, or maybe make a few big changes.
Well, you know, I would say this year, more than ever before, it's hard to make that case that I did say before, that if there would be no UN, well, we'd have to create it. I think it's still true. If we would destroy the UN today, the governments would need to meet in an international forum. There are many issues around the world that need global regulation, and not in the extreme sense of the world, but just to share information, whether it's health issues. We saw with the coronavirus, the WHO largely failed. But the idea that countries need to communicate on epidemics is obvious. So is on telecommunications and refugees. And there's so many global issues. The world gets smaller and smaller. And countries do need to communicate. They need a forum. And often we do need global agencies to help with these things. So there's no silver bullet to solve the problem. Again, even if you got rid of the UN, the same phenomena would reproduce in other fora. So FIFA, which is the International Federation of Football, which in America is called soccer, they would meet there to try to kick out Israel. Or the signatories
which
of the
they have,
which they
way.
Have, and signatories of the Red Cross have can have their own meetings, and so the same phenomena of 56 Islamic countries seeking to demonize Israel, joined by the dictatorships, with others joining for the reasons that I described, it would recreate itself in other fora. So not easy to get rid of it, but you asked about what would be the model for the UN. So I know where it begins. It begins with having democracies doing the right thing. So one of the great things that we do that does give me optimism is that every year UN Watch, together with 25 other human rights groups, not the large ones that have gone astray, like Amnesty and HRW, Human Rights Watch, which have become ideological and radicalized, but groups of human rights dissidents from Cuba, from Venezuela, from China, from Iran, from the Uyghurs, we work with them, and we organize every year for the past 16 or 17 years the Geneva Summit for Human Rights. We started in 2009. It's a very large event. It'll be held this year in Geneva on February 18th. Everyone who's watching is invited to come. Attendance is free. GenevaSummit.org. GenevaSummit.org.
February 18th, 2025.
In Geneva, yeah. So we bring champions of human rights. This year we're going to bring Vladimir Kara-Murza. Poisoned twice, like Navalny, but poisoned twice, went into a coma each time by the Putin regime because he dared to speak out against his serial abuses of human rights. He was in America, he went back to Russia right after they invaded Ukraine. In Moscow, on CNN, he called Vladimir Putin a war criminal. 2 hours later, they came to take him away, threw him in prison, sentenced him to 25 years in prison for treason. Threw him in a dungeon in Siberia in solitary confinement. He was getting emaciated and left to die. We feared he would die. He thought he would die. Thank God there was a prisoner exchange with Evan Gershkovitz of the Wall Street Journal, several others, and thankfully his name got thrown into the mix and he was freed. He's going to be there in February. He's a friend of mine. We've hosted him before. He just got out of prison a few months ago. His wife, for 2 years, was going all around the world, and we helped her to fight for his release. It's going to be very emotional. His wife, who last year was on stage fighting for his freedom, Vladimir coming free. So we're going to have real heroes like that who confronted the worst regimes in the name of freedom for their country, for their people. So we're going to have those. And that's, I mentioned that. You asked about a model for the UN. We show the world what needs to be done on the worst dictatorships. All of our democracies should be at the UN introducing resolutions and statements and events and conferences and emergency sessions for the real victims of the world's worst human rights abuses. From time to time, they do it. The Western countries do have an annual resolution on Iran in New York, and it's mostly a good resolution. There's some diplomatic language that praises Iran, but most of the resolution is good. And there are a number of resolutions, but it's a small amount. There is nothing on China. No one's ever dared to introduce a resolution on China. I think America tried to do it in Geneva a couple of years ago, maybe one exception. But for two decades, no one did it. No one introduces a resolution on Egypt, which has thousands of political prisoners. Zimbabwe, nothing. Pakistan, a horrific country where they throw acid on women's faces if they think that they're not wearing the right head covering. Pakistan has never been condemned once. It's just a long, long list. So at a minimum, for a model UN, let our democracies do the right thing. People ask me, and I'll stop my rant, but people ask me, you know, what reforms do we need? I say, no. Don't talk about reforms, because the UN loves to talk about, oh, we're going to do a reform and a committee, and we're going to move that mechanism here, and then we're going to add a bolt there, and that. No, we don't need anything. Just the existing mechanisms allow the United States, Germany, and France to call an emergency special session in Geneva on what's happening in Syria, on what's happening in Iran. They can introduce resolutions. There's so much they can do today, and they don't even do it. So at a minimum, our democracies need to step up to the plate and turn the UN mechanisms into the tools for human rights defense and protection that they were meant to be.
I have so many more questions. I wonder whether you should get more votes if you're a democracy. I wonder if there's many ways, and I want to pick your brain. But I do want to ask a question that my wife actually was very interested. We were watching you doing things, my wife heard in Greenspan, and she asked, maybe because she's also observing me in the past year, you spend your day surrounded by and speaking with or to people that hate you. How do you do it?
Yeah, look, I don't have the easy answer. I don't know. I know that I'm committed to the truth, and when I walk into the room, I feel the enmity. I've said that I'm the most hated man at the UN, and it's not a speculation. We didn't talk about it, but they've tried to shut me down. I mean, things that are seen when I speak, I get interrupted by all the regimes that I mentioned, the North Koreans, the Chinese, the Pakistanis, the Palestinian. They interrupt me. They say, Mr. President, don't let him speak. He's saying the wrong thing. He's not respecting our traditions of the council. You have the worst dictators in the world saying he's not respecting our traditions. And so that's the seen part. The unseen part is how the bureaucrats, a French bureaucrat, his name is Eric Testounet, was the senior bureaucrat at the Human Rights Council. There was a show, you may have watched it in Israel, but it's a British show called Yes, Prime Minister. Yes, Minister, Yes, Prime Minister. And I don't know if Americans know the show, but it was a show how there was the minister, eventually the prime minister, who's nominally the head of the office of the ministry. But in fact, Sir Humphrey, the bureaucrat, is actually really running things. And at the Human Rights Council, the chair changes every year. One year it's Argentina, the next year it might be Switzerland. But actually the bureaucrat, the Sir Humphrey, is running everything. And his name for 25 years was Eric Testounet, and he hated me. He would wake up in the morning and say, I got to get this guy Hillel Neuer. He's exposing what we're doing, because I knew where the bodies are buried, and I knew how he was changing press releases, how he was manipulating things all the time. And so he would try to persecute me. I would sign up to speak, and he would delete my name from the list, and he would send internal emails telling his staff how to tell lies about me on the internet, emails that came to me because there were some, at least one decent person among his team who told me what he was doing. So there, to come to your question about the dealing with the enmity and the hatred, there's the visible persecution of being interrupted, and then there's the less visible, where the speakers list for the past few years were completely manipulated so that I couldn't speak. One year I signed up for 36 speeches, and the computer came back and said, you have zero, which is literally impossible. The woman who wrote the program said, Hillel, her name is Emma Riley, I worked for the UN, said, I wrote the program. It's impossible to have that result. And because Eric Testounet would just manipulate it. So dealing with this kind of persecution, and again, it's not physical persecution, so I don't want to compare myself to those who've done it, but it was extreme censorship and you know, social isolation, some NGOs.
Nobody wants to be called out by the watchdog.
Right. So it's not easy. And there are times, I'd say, certainly when it's those from the democratic world who you feel are joining, if it's NGOs who are joining in, some of the radical NGOs treat me that I'm contaminated. And so it's easier when it's a dictatorship. It's a badge of honor. And all I want to say is that when I go into the room and I feel the hatred, I get 90 seconds to speak. And I'm just focused like a laser on what I can do to make a difference in my 90 seconds. My comparison is a doctor, a surgeon, when he or she goes into the operating room. If it were me, I would go in and there'd be a body lying there who's been shot and there's blood and guts. I would faint from the scenes of blood. But the surgeon cannot allow herself or himself to faint. They have to focus on how to get the bullet out and save the patient. And they're just focused like a laser. And there's horrible things. There's blood and guts all over the operating table, and they're just focused. I have my 90 seconds. And in the room, there's hundreds of people in the room, and there's people sometimes sort of literally in my face and hostility all around, and I'm getting interrupted, and they're banging on the gavel. And I'm just focused on getting my words out, knowing that some speeches can be seen 10 million times. Speeches that I gave, Where Are Your Jews, which many people know about it, which a question I posed to Algeria and Syria and Egypt and Iraq, or when we brought the son of Hamas and he spoke, it was seen 10 million times. So knowing that it's an occasion to do something good, so I'm just focused on the possibilities and try to block out all the noise and all the hate and just focus on the good that we can do.
That takes a lot of strength. So I try to end every, I end every episode with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round. It's a series of questions. Just give the first answer if it comes to mind. There's no right or wrong answer. You get one pass and I get to say if you'll get the pass. I get a sense that you will. Hillel Noor, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I like rap music.
Any one specific?
Many, none specific.
That's very UN diplomatic. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That's a good question. There's many Jewish hockey players.
Spoken like a true Canadian. What is your favorite curse? English, French?
Kalis sakramem udzi tabernak.
Wait, say that again?
No, I'm not going to say it again. That's French-Canadian.
What does it mean?
It's French-Canadian. Those are words from the church in French Canada and Quebec. The holy words became curse words. I'm not sure if there's an equivalent in English.
I mean, it is. Everyone stubs their toe and says, Jesus Christ.
That's the equivalent. Bravo. Okay. That's it. So you say kalis in French. It's the chalice, which is in Hebrew is the kos that holds the wine in church, the chalice. Sacrament is the sacrament. Mozi is damnation, but it's also a church word. Tabernak is the tabernacle, in Hebrew the Mishkan. So those are the French-Canadian swear words. Mozi, tabernak, sacrament, mozi, and ostzi, which is the host, which is sort of the wafer in church. So those are the French-Canadian swear words.
Right. When was the last time you cried?
That's a good question. I don't remember.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner for any moment in history, who would that be?
Yaakov Herzog. He was Israel's ambassador to Canada. He did many other things. He was director of the Prime Minister's office of Levi Eshkol. He was a leading advisor to Israeli leaders in the 1950s and 60s. And he was born in Dublin. His father was Chief Rabbi Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was the Chief Rabbi of Dublin, who then became the first Chief Rabbi of Israel, succeeding Rav Kook, who was the first Chief Rabbi of British Mandatory Palestine. And he was a great visionary who was a Talmid Chacham, which means a very learned man in Judaism, who was at one point in the 60s, could have become the Chief Rabbi of the UK. He lived in Israel, but he could have become the Chief Rabbi of the UK or to be head of the Prime Minister's office. So he was qualified to be one of the most eminent rabbis of the time and to be one of the most eminent political advisors of the time in Israel. Brilliant person. And I'll just share with you a brief story. In 1961, in January, he was Israeli ambassador in Ottawa. And the great historian of the time, Arnold Toynbee, was visiting Montreal, McGill University, where he repeated what he wrote in his books, that the Jews were extinct for 2,000 years. They don't exist anymore. If you see them, they're a fossil. And various anti-Semitic statements about the Jews over history. And he said Israelis are Nazis. 1961, not amnesty today, but 1961. And Yaakov Herzog challenged him to a debate, which today no ambassador would challenge the great historian of our time to a debate. He did. And a fascinating intellectual debate was held at the Hillel Association of McGill University on Stanley Street in downtown Montreal. My teacher, Professor Kotler, was a 20-year-old student, was there on the dais to help organize the event. And it's a historic debate. I advise everyone, you can see it on the internet, the Herzog-Toynbee debate. And Yaakov Herzog was just a brilliant person who thought deeply about history, the Jewish people, theology, a brilliant diplomat. And he has a book called The People That Dwells Alone. I think it's a fascinating book and something that gives me a lot of things to think about. And someone that I would, he died as a young man. He died in the 70s. I think he was barely 50 years old. And someone that I would love to have Shabbat dinner with.
Great. People That Dwells Alone.
Magnificent book. I don't think it's in print, but it can be found in libraries near you.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Sukkot.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I guess Yom Kippur, I guess.
When do you feel safest?
I don't know. I never thought about that. But like, you know, sitting on my couch watching TV, that's a time of relaxation. I don't get to do it very often. I should, but...
When do you feel least safe?
Sadly, today, because of my work, there are many instances where I don't feel safe, because not only do I speak out against terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and the Islamic regime of Iran, which sends assassins around the world to assassinate dissidents and officials, but we also speak out against evil dictatorships like Vladimir Putin, who poisons people, and other regimes who murder their dissidents. So sadly, today, there are many instances when I don't feel so safe.
What gives you hope?
A lot of things. I mentioned the Geneva summit when we bring these heroes who've been in prison in China, in Russia and Iran, in Venezuela, and who have the triumph of the human spirit not to give up. They face the world's worst regimes and they do it with conviction, and some of them get out, like Vladimir Kara-Murza, someone we campaigned for and got out. That gives us tremendous hope.
A lot of hope. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
Morris Abram, our founder.
And finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want listeners to donate to this week? And I'm going to say UN Watch, because I think what you're doing is extremely important and should be celebrated by Jews and non-Jews. You now can say whatever other organization.
Well, there are so many. I'm just going to mention one because of the time. I think it was 2 weeks ago that an innocent rabbi in Dubai was murdered from Chabad. And as someone who tries to keep kosher around the world and to be connected to Judaism when I travel, so many times that I'm in different places around the world, we go to Chabad houses, which tries to provide Jewish services, kosher food, and a synagogue, especially for tourists, and give them a Shabbat meal when they're traveling. So just to give, as we say in Hebrew, hakarat atov, to give gratitude, and especially that they're on the front lines, being visibly Jewish. If you are wearing a kippah, you're visibly Jewish, you're a target more than ever in the world. So it's very courageous for, even in Europe. I mean, in Europe, I used to wear a kippah on Shabbat outside in Europe after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, where ISIS terrorists went to a kosher grocery store in Paris and massacred people, and they massacred journalists. Basically, if you're a journalist doing caricatures against criticizing religion, including Islam, but others, you're targeted for death. And if you're a Jew buying a challah right before Shabbat, you're targeted for death. When that happened in Paris, which is not so far from Geneva, I began to be more scared about, you know, wearing a kippah outside. But the Chabad rabbis and other rabbis who go out and are visibly Jewish, it's very courageous. They're standing up and being publicly Jewish. And this innocent young man was murdered in Dubai for the crime of being a rabbi who's trying to help people. So I'm gonna mention Chabad.
Great point. Hillel, where can people find you? Where can they find UN Watch?
Well, hopefully they can never find me because I'm trying to be evasive with all the bad guys in the world. But no, that's a joke. I go to a lot of events. But UN Watch is, we have a website, unwatch.org. People can sign up. We invite everyone who cares about the issues that I described. You need to be informed. The best way to be informed, sign up on our website. We have a newsletter once or twice a week.
Social media?
Social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook hasn't been so friendly to us, but Twitter and Instagram, either Hillel Neuer or UN Watch.
How do you spell Hillel Neuer? Just
N-E-U-E-R.
Hillel Neuer or and UN Watch. I could listen to you speak for hours. Actually, I prepared a lot more questions, but I
gave long answers. I'm sorry.
I love your answers. I think it's so important to facts matter. Reality must matter. And thank you for shedding light on the truth. Thank you for, you know, sticking it to the man. Thank you for standing up for what's right. And I'm just very grateful for you being here. And so here I am with Hillel Neuer.
Thank you. Great to spend time with you, and bravo on the superb work you do. I was on campus a number of years ago when I was a student, and there was one professor, his name is Professor Fred Krantz, who stood up in Montreal in the 1980s when we were being oppressed in the ways that students are today, and did tremendous work to help me become a writer and stand up and have courage. And today there's Shai Davidai who stands up, and I hope other people will follow your example. It's so important. So bravo and great to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."